This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You probably know my guest, John Mellencamp, for his hits from the 80s like Jack and Diane and Small Town, and of course for his song This Is Our Country that first became famous when it was used in a Chevrolet ad. Democratic and Republican candidates have used his songs in their campaigns. At the Obama inaugural celebration at the Lincoln Memorial, Mellencamp sang his song Pink Houses, the one with the refrain, Ain't That America for You and Me. Mellencamp has a new CD called Life, Death, and Freedom, which has some great songs about mortality. New York Times music critic John Pareles wrote, it's an album presented like a deathbed testament, bleak, solitary, bluesy, and unbowed. Mellencamp is going to perform some old and new songs for us. But let's start with the opening track of his new CD. The song is called Longest Days.
Seems like once upon a time ago, I was where I was supposed to be. My vision was true and my heart was too. There was no end to what I could dream. I walked like a hero into the setting sun. Everyone called out my name. Death to me was just a mystery. I was too busy raising a cane. But nothing lasts forever. The best efforts don't always pay. Sometimes you get sick and you don't get better. That's when life is short, even in its longest day.
John Mellencamp, welcome to Fresh Air. I have to say, you know, I just wasn't prepared for this song that opens the new CD. It's just so much about mortality and things that aren't necessarily ever going to get better. When I first started listening to the song, I think I was kind of depressed. It was the middle of winter, and it really spoke to me. Sometimes you really need songs like this, so thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. The song actually was... That line, my grandmother lived to be 100 years old. And it's a funny, it's not a funny ha-ha story, but this is how the line came about. I used to go see her in the afternoons, and sometimes she'd make me lay in bed with her. You know, I was like 45 years old or something. And my 100-year-old grandmother, but she'd call me Buddy, and she'd go, Buddy, come and lay down with me. And I'd go, okay. So I'd lay in bed with her, and we'd talk sometimes, and you know, she was great up until about 99, and then she started getting kind of dementia and stuff like that. And one afternoon I was laying in bed with her, and she said, let's pray. And I said, okay. And so she starts praying, and she says, God, you know, Buddy and I are ready to come home. And I went, whoa, wait a minute, Grandma, you're ready to come home. Buddy's only 45, he's not ready. And then she turned at me and looked at me right in the face, and her face all of a sudden looked like a little girl. And she goes, Buddy, life is short in its longest days. And I always remembered that line, and I thought, well, surely someday I'll be able to work that line into a song. And that's how that song started.
You know, it's funny that, you know, your grandmother would have said life is short in its longest days, because one of the things I like so much about the song is that hook, and it's so, although this isn't a country song per se, there's so many country songs that have that kind of contradictory language in its title. Like Roger Miller has a song called More and More I Miss You Less and Less. You know, that that kind of like contradiction. And so you just got that from her.
Well, you know, I don't really see it as a contradiction itself. I just think it's a true statement. I mean,
yeah.
I look at my kids and I look at myself and I go, wow, what happened? You know, where did this all go? And of course, my parents were very explicit with me about, you know, John, time goes by real quick, and you know, you better try to enjoy every moment. My dad has been retired from his job since he was 49 years old, and he's 79 now. And every day he says the same thing to me. He says, "Did you do anything fun for yourself today?" And I'll go, "No, Dad, I'm working." He goes, you got to do something for yourself, fun every day, because if you don't, then life is going to pass you by, and you just, you know, what good is it?
No, I mean, you're obviously feeling that song that we just heard, Longest Days, but it's also great song craft. At the risk of kind of killing the lyric, let me just, like, read a few lines. Nothing lasts forever. Your best efforts don't always pay. Sometimes you get sick and you don't get better. That's why life is short, even in its longest days. Can you talk a little bit about your process of writing a song like this? You were telling us that the main hook, the Life is Short line, basically came from your grandmother, but what about the rest of it?
Well, you know, as I've matured as a songwriter, I realize that if it's out there, it's mine. You know, everything I see and hear, I don't care if Shakespeare wrote it, or Tennessee Williams wrote it, or if Bob Dylan wrote it, or I see it on a sitcom. If I hear words, they're mine. And so I will take ideas from any place, anywhere, anytime, and life has become a song to me. I'm always looking for a song. And then what happens is that I'll sit down, and if I have to labor over the song, generally the song is not very good. My best songs are just given to me from someplace outside myself, and I think it's because I have thought about a particular topic for so long that eventually it assembles itself in my head or in heaven, one of the two, sometimes in hell, and they just kind of come to me all in a thought. Sometimes, like the Longest Days, I got up one morning and the song came to me in a complete thought. Hmm. All I had to do was get up and write it down. There was no laboring about rhymes or melody or any of that stuff. It just was, there it is. And when that happens, you know, you just kind of got to look up and go, thank you.
Right. Well, my guest is John Mellencamp, and his new CD is called Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. John, you're in your studio, and you have your guitar with you. So I'm going to ask you if you could sing another song pertaining to mortality from the new CD, and this is called A Ride Back Home.
Hey, Jesus, can you give me a ride back home? I've been out here in this world too long on my own. I won't bother you no more if you can just get me in the door. Hey, Jesus, can you give me a ride back home? When I started out, I was so young and so strong. I just let it roll off my back when things went wrong. Now it's starting to get to me, all of this inhumanity. Hey, Jesus, can you give me a ride back home?
Thank you. And that's John Mellencamp performing a song from his new CD, Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. Do you mind if I ask what kind of religion you were brought up with? Like what church was like when you were young?
Well, my grandmother, back to my grandmother, made sure that I went to church every Sunday. And she'd come over and pick us boys up, and we would go to the Nazarene Church. And back then, that was about as close to heaven as I ever got, because just the time to be able to spend with her, and she was very, very religious. But see, you know, I'm in. I don't even worry about it, because before she died, she said, "Listen, buddy, when you die, I'll be waiting on you, and you're in." So I figure, you know, I don't. I got nothing to do. She's taking care of it for me. So if there is a heaven, I'm in. So I don't even think about it. Although she did say, "Buddy, you're going to have to stop that cussing." But other than that, you know, if I can just clean up my language, I'm pretty sure I'm in the Golden Gates. So I trust her and I believe her. And so, yeah, I grew up Nazarene. That's where I went to church. And then finally, about 17 or 18. I just kind of quit going.
And now?
And now, Oh, the church would fall down if I walked in. I'm not a big advocate of organized American religion.
Here's another mortality question, if you don't mind. You know, as I've been saying, there's a bunch of songs on the new CD that are about mortality. You had heart surgery in the 1990s, right?
I had a mild heart attack because I smoke and because I have high cholesterol. And for 10 years before that, the doctors were telling me, John, you need to get on cholesterol medicine. My answer was always the same. Am I all right now? And they go, yeah, you're all right now, but you're heading for disaster. Okay, well, I'll deal with disaster when it gets here. Well, it got here. So I have no one to blame or anything like that about having a heart malfunction. But I did not have open heart surgery or anything like that.
So this was more than 10 years ago.
Actually, it was 1994.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't writing songs like this then, were you?
Yes, I was. I've been writing. See, the problem is that music is so... you know, during the 80s and the 70s, and, you know, the songs and the arrangements of the songs had to be a certain way to get on the radio, and it really screwed up songs. It really messed up. I've been writing about this stuff forever. I've been writing about mortality. I've been writing about, you know, I only write four songs. Come on, I got the same four songs, and I just rewrite them, you know, 50 times, but I got four topics that I cover. You know, I cover race, and I cover what you're calling mortality. And then I, you know, sometimes write about girls, but I'm too old to write about that now. So, you know, I only got a few things I write about. But if you listen to songs that I've written, some people ain't no damn good. They, you know, that song is about mortality. When the walls come crumbling down, it was about the government. So because of the music and the lightness and the arrangements of the music of that time were of a certain ilk and even got worse in the 90s, the songs, to be able to be on the radio, really had to take on a candy-coated appeal. Pink Houses was always anti-Reaganomics. People loved the Ain't That America. So, you know, people take from songs only what they want to hear. And, I'm just like everybody else. So you kind of got to lift up the veil of a lot of songwriters' songs to really realize what's being said.
Well, let's take, I think, an excellent example of what you're talking about, which is This Is Our Country. And a lot of people know that song from the Chevrolet Silverado ad. And it sounds like, you know, an American anthem when you just hear...
The chorus.
Right. But I'm going to ask you to sing a verse from it that... gives a very different impression than what people might have walked away from the ad. And this is, can you do the verse that goes, and there's room enough here for religion to forgive? And room enough here for science to live?
Well, there's room enough here. Let me see if I can do it. Well, there's room enough here for science. I got a cigarette in my mouth. I take it
out. No, take it out.
Hold on. All right, here we go. Well, there's room enough here for science to live, and there's room enough here for religion to forgive and try to understand all the people of this land. This is our country. Yeah, I think that, you know, simply because it was my one and only television commercial, that outraged a lot of people, and what the song is really about was missed. But, you know, I knew that was going to happen. But I really had no idea how much that song was going to be played.
This Is Our Country is kind of like a plea to end the culture wars, to be inclusive, to respect each other.
Yes.
Do you feel it became an anthem for something else in the minds of many people?
Oh, I don't care. I mean, it became an anthem for Chevrolet, I think.
Right.
I mean, because that's how they discovered the song. Because they couldn't discover the song in the way that they discovered Pink Houses, or the way that they discovered you know, I Need a Lover. It's impossible to, you know, to discover a song that way.
But what went through your mind when Chevrolet asked you to use it? Did you think immediately this would be a good idea? Did you have reservations about it?
Oh, listen, I had spoken out against. I was the same way that you are, and I still don't think that an artist should have to get involved with Wall Street on any level. That's not what I really do. I don't write songs for commercials, but I did this because I thought, well, perhaps they are right. I had so many people saying, John, you have turned down fortunes and fortunes of money. And now is the time. The music business has changed. Nobody is, your songs can't grow from the ground up anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So go from it from a different angle. So that's what we did.
And what did you learn from the experience?
I learned that an artist shouldn't have to do this. This is not what my songs are about. But I also learned that Chevrolet was a better record company than Columbia.
Because they got your song out there.
Well, because they also, what they said they were going to do, they did. They kept their word.
Which was?
Well, record companies never keep their word. That's the point of the whole conversation.
Uh-huh, okay.
Record companies say we're going to do this, this, and this, and this, and they never did any of it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Mellencamp, and he has a new CD, which is called Life, Death, Love, and Freedom.
Sorry, honey.
I also want to talk with you about Pink Houses, which is the song that John McCain had briefly used in his campaign. And we'll talk about what happened with that. But play the hook from it so everybody knows the song.
Let's see how that goes. Ain't that America? Okay, here we go. Ain't that America for you and me? Ain't that America something to see, babe? Ain't that America, home of the free, yeah? Little pink houses for you and me.
So when you found out John McCain was using it in his campaign, and you are a lifelong Democrat, how did you decide to handle it?
I wouldn't say I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm very liberal.
Okay, right. You can vote whatever you want, but you're very liberal.
I'm very liberal.
Got it.
Yes, I'm
yeah.
very liberal. Well, what happened was is that I called up my publicity guy, a guy named Bob Merlis. I said, Bob said, you know, McCain's using your song. And I said, well, he can use it if he wants to, but you probably ought to write him a letter and say, you know, not only, you know, that you guys are using it, but so is Barack Obama, so is John Edwards, so is Hillary Clinton. And you should understand that Mellencamp is very liberal, and do you really think that it's pushing your agenda in the right direction? I mean, you're just really falling in line with all the other liberal candidates. Maybe you guys should rethink using the song. We didn't tell him not to use it. We just wrote a letter that said, you know, why don't you guys might want to rethink about using this song. And they quit using it.
When you write songs like Pink Houses or This Is Our Country or R-O-C-K in the USA, do you think I'm going to sit down and write an anthem?
No, not really, because if you hear me play these songs, like you just heard me, they're not anthems at all. They're folk songs.
That's true.
I mean, you know, like I just played the chorus of Pink Houses. That's not an anthem. That's a folk song. But see, that's what I was talking about. And all the songs that you named were music from the 80s that had to be, you know, dressed up in a certain way or they weren't going to be on the radio. If I, like, you know, I'm going to go out on tour and I'm going to play just me and acoustic guitar, and all of these songs take on a whole different feeling or meaning when you hear me playing by myself, because they're not wrapped up in the music of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They're just songs. I'll give you a good example. Hold on. Listen. I need a lover that won't drive me crazy. I need a lover that won't drive me mad. I need a lover that won't drive me crazy. I need a girl like one I ain't never had. It's a whole different song.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
It's a whole different song than the song that you grew up hearing and you know, I grew up playing. But that's what the music of the time required. But don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining. I was very fortunate. I had a lot of hit records. And, you know, I'm 57 years old. I'm still out playing shows, and people still know my songs. And so, you know, I feel very fortunate about all that. So I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that, you know, trying to be an artist inside the music business has always been challenging for me.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Mellencamp. He has a new CD called Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. His hits from the 80s include Jack and Diane and Small Town. His song This Is Our Country became famous when it was used in a Chevy ad. At the Obama inaugural celebration at the Lincoln Memorial, Mellencamp sang a song, Pink Houses. He grew up in a small town in Indiana. I asked him to tell us about the first records he bought.
The first record I ever bought was The Twist. With my own money, I bought that by Chubby Checker, and I was like maybe, you know, 7 or 6 years old. This girl that lived next door to us, her and I entered the twist contest in the window of the dime store in Seymour, Indiana, and we won the twist contest. But we didn't really have any twist music, so I had to go buy Chubby Checker. But I grew up in a household where my dad is only 20 years older than me, so my dad had, you know, I had access to a lot of music, and my dad thought at the time, I think he was, you know, him and his buddy had bongo parties where they bongo. So, you know, I was exposed to Woody Guthrie, Odetta, you know, all kind of music through my father's record collection. So, and I had an older brother who was 4 years older than me, who also played guitar and was really a much better singer than me.
Could you maybe play an excerpt of a song that you feel is like in your DNA because you heard it and loved it when you were young? Either a song that you discovered on your own or a song from your father's collection that's just kind of in your blood?
Let me see. Come gather around people wherever you roam and admit that the waters around you have grown and soon you'll sink like a stone. Anyway, my brother had that, brought that record home in 1963, 1962, whatever year it came out, and it made a huge impression on me, that Bob Dylan fella.
Yeah, what impact did Dylan have on you when you were young?
Well, I mean, he was ultimate songwriter. You know, I never even considered writing songs until I was much older, because I was a singer in a rock band. You know, I was in a bar. You remember, you know, the mid-70s. There were so many rock bars. You know, and I was one of those guys, you know, playing and singing. And there was no reason for me to write a song, because there were so many beautiful songs out. And you know, in one hand, you know, I had Bob Dylan, and in the other hand, I had Iggy Pop, you know, and we would go from a Dylan song to a Stooges song all in one set. So, you know, there was no reason for me to write songs. So, but Bob Dylan was always the ultimate songwriter, and nobody could ever write a song as good as him, and nobody ever has written songs as good as him, and, you know, so, you know, what I thought it...
So what made you think about writing songs, not just singing them?
I got a record deal.
And you had to write because of that?
Yeah.
Really? So you hadn't written songs
before? Oh, you know, I'd written songs, you know, to get girls to come over to the house or something. But other than that, you know, I was never really serious about songwriting until probably 80-something or another.
Let me stop you. So when you'd write a song to get a girl to come over to the house,
yeah,
would you stare into her eyes in a dreamy way as you played the song?
No, I never had to do that.
No?
I never had to do that. They just dropped everything. I don't think I was...
If you say so.
I don't think I was the only one. That's my point, you know. I'm not saying they dropped everything for me. They just, you know, girls at that time, if you had a guitar, they liked you. And, you know, I wasn't the only one. I mean, you know, there was a long line of guys walking around my town with the guitar case. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if I wrote a song, it was only for the entertainment of female company or a little story that I might write about something that happened around the house, but I never really was.
Do you remember any of those early songs? Could I impose on you to play a few bars of one of them?
I don't know if I can even remember any of them. I remember the first song I learned on guitar.
Okay.
I was 9 years old. Railroad Bill, lived way up on Railroad Hill. Ride, ride, ride. Railroad Bill, well, he never worked and he never will. Ride, ride, ride. That's the first song I ever learned on guitar.
I don't think I know that. Whose is that?
Oh, it's just an old folk song. I'm a folk singer, you know, and that's what I always did. You know, I'd always been in bands, but I was always, always had an acoustic guitar and always sang those old American folk songs, you know.
And yet, I read that in one of your bar bands, you did a lot of James Brown covers.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, James Brown was, you know, he was the Bob Dylan of soul. I mean, you know, sure, I was in a band called the Crepe Soul, and that's all we did. It was me and I hate to identify him in this fashion, but a black kid, me and a black kid were lead singers. I was 14, he was 18, and everybody else in the band was 21. Now, can you imagine letting a 14-year-old kid get in a car today with a bunch of 21-year-old guys going to a bar every weekend and playing? But my parents let me do it, and that's how I did, and I'd bring home $25, $35 every weekend. They were happy about it.
So you moved from Indiana to New York to get close to the record industry.
That's not true.
No? Okay, go ahead.
No. I moved from Indiana to London.
Oh.
And I lived in London in 1977 and 78. And the only reason I moved to London that I had a record deal when I actually, here's what happened. It's a boring story. It's the same old story you've heard a million times. Anyway, I go to New York, and I wanted to take a look at the New York Art Student League, or I wanted to get a record deal. I didn't really care which. Is it going to be a painter or a songwriter? Since the Art Student League cost a lot of money, that was out because I had no money. And I went there, and it wasn't this simple, but I got a record deal pretty rapidly. And then it was, I made a couple records that were terrible. I was managed by the same guy that managed Bowie. And he tried to recreate me into an American David Bowie. It just didn't work. And him and I fought all the time. And that's where Johnny Cougar came from. And all
was that his idea?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a terrible idea. I told him at the time it was a terrible idea. And, of course, he didn't like that. You know, he wasn't going to take that from snappy young brats such as myself. You know, he was the P.T. Barnum of the whole thing. He created David Bowie and reminded me of that all the time. But anyway, so I was with him for, you know, I made a couple records with him that were terrible, terrible, not worth listening, not worth looking at. And then I met a manager who was a shyster, and he said, you know, I can't get a record deal here in the United States for you, but if you come to London, I can get one in Europe. So we moved to London, and I lived in London for 2 years. And it was a great experience, and eye-opening for, you know, to move from Seymour, Indiana to London, England, and be living on right in Chelsea, and the whole punk rock thing was just starting to explode, and there I was with an acoustic guitar.
Right. So it was really hard for you to get rid of the Cougar thing, wasn't it?
Oh, it's never going, it'll never leave. I still walk down the street and people will say, hey, John Cougar, you know, I hear it all the time, or John Cougar Mellencamp, I'll be introduced that way. But, you know, that's what it was, you know. I mean, that's what people, you know, knew me as at that time. And that's, you know, that's just the fate. That's, you know, that's the way God handed it out to me. And that's the cards I'm dealt. And so I deal with it.
Let me ask you about one of your early hits. And this is Jack and Diane from 1982. Well, there's a great line in that. Life goes on even after the thrill of living is gone.
See, there you go. Now we're talking about mortality again.
Yes, exactly. I know that occurred to me. that definitely occurred to me. Can you talk about how that line came to you?
Well, actually, they're putting together a box set of my songs. And the guy was just here yesterday who's producing it, was working on it. And this guy's leaving no stone unturned. So he found a song that I had written before Jack and Diane called Jenny at 16. that had some of the same lines from Jack and Diane in it that I had abandoned that song, Jenny at 16, and turned it into Jack and Diane. And in the original writing of Jack and Diane, he discovered that Jack was black. So even back then, I was talking about interracial things, but for some reason or another had abandoned that idea. So Jack and Diane was originally about an interracial couple, but I guess in 1981, I think maybe I decided maybe this is a little too pushing it too far, because, you know, this country is a pretty racist place, and so particularly in 81.
Can you do a few bars of Jack and Diane?
Yeah. Hold on. A little ditty about Jack and Diane, two man kids growing up in the heartland. Jackie gonna be a football star, Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Second on chili dog, outside taste freeze, Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, got his hands between the knees. Jackie said, hey, Diane, let's run off behind the shade of trees. Dribble off those Bobby Brooks, girl, let me do what I please. Oh, yeah, life goes on. Long after the thrill of living is gone. Oh, yeah, say life goes on. Long after the thrill of living is gone. They walk on. That's it.
Did you know when you were writing that it would be really good to put in, like, details in the song, like the Tasty Freeze or the Chili Dogs? I mean, like, story writers think of details like that. Songwriters don't always.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I can say this very crudely to you. A lot of those songs back then were not really written in my mind. They were written, you know, below my belt. They were songs that were only emotional. There was no, I wasn't sophisticated enough to think, oh, I should put a detail in here. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a guy in a band in a bar. And, you know, I saw what people did and partook in what people did in those bars. I was part of that scene in the Midwest. And it was a, you know, it was a rough-ass crowd some nights, and some nights it wasn't, you know. So, that's where songs like Lonely All Night came from. Music was a sideline for me at that time. You know, all my songs are written below my belt. And then, and as I got older, they kind of raised up to my head and became more of, you know, you should pay attention to what you're writing because people are actually listening.
My guest is John Mellencamp, and his new CD is called Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. I wanted to ask you something, and this gets back to what we were talking about early on about mortality. And this question might strike you as kind of odd and a real stretch, and maybe it is, but I know that you were born with a tumor on your spine.
I was born with spina bifida.
That's like an opening in your spine, isn't it?
Yes, that's what it is.
That's really dangerous.
Well, in 1951, it was deadly. In 1951, you know, they would operate on people with, you know, with pinking shears and screwdrivers, and and, you know, they were still giving people lobotomies in 1951. You know, so the medical world was pretty not developed, not like today. And I was born with spina bifida, and it used to be the practice to let the baby lay there for 2 or 3 weeks, and if the baby survived, then they would operate on the baby. Thank God for me. That there was a young doctor named Dr. Heinberger at Riley's Children's Hospital in Indianapolis who said, we've got to stop this, letting these kids die and letting them lay there because they won't survive. So let's, the minute we see it, let's operate on them. And that's what he did with me. And generally, if you are born with that disease, you're, wherever they operate on you from, you're crippled from that point down. My hole in my spine was right below my ears, so I should have been crippled from the neck down.
Do you think, and this is the part that's like really the stretch, because you were born so vulnerable and that you had a condition that nearly killed you, that could have killed you, do you think that you have some like retention of that, and that there's something like deep inside that has always been in touch with mortality and vulnerability because of that? I mean, and even if you weren't aware of it, like your parents would have been.
Well, my parents didn't even tell me until I was, until some kid at school said to me when I was about in sixth, seventh, fifth or sixth grade, I'm sure. I was sitting in class and some kid goes, "Man, what's that big scar across the back of your neck?" And I said, "What scar?" I didn't know there was a scar on the back of my neck. Apparently, my parents told my brothers not to say anything to me, and they never said anything to me. And so I remember going home and going, "What's the scar on my neck?" And then I got the whole nine yards. And at, 9 or 10 years old, I didn't much care. No, at that time, I didn't care because I figured, well, I've been a normal kid thus far. I have no reason to believe that I won't be anything but a normal kid. And I played football, and I ran track, and played baseball, and, I did everything everybody else did. But, I don't see that scar on the back of my neck, but, I've been married to Elaine for 17 years, and she said the first time she kissed me and she put her hand on the back of my neck, she thought, "What the world is that?"
Can I close by asking you to do a song that you did not write, that you really love, that's by somebody else?
Okay, I will play a song that I have played at every party.
Oh, great. Okay.
That this is my party song, when they hand me a guitar and say, "John, play something." Everybody's laughing at the Early Bird Cafe. I've been hidden there since yesterday, and I believe I've lost my way. Charlotte's there in Albany, and Billy's there in Suede. There's money in their pockets, all the dues are paid. And there's wine on every table, and there's food on every plate. Well, I hope I get there pretty soon, before it gets too late. Well, I ran on down the road a while to the other side of town. My clothes were getting wrinkled, and my socks were falling down. But I could not stop to pull them up, in fear that I'd be late. So I kept on running down the road until I saw the gate of the Early Bird Cafe, glowing golden like the sun. Everybody kept on singing, "Can come on," and we just begun. Well, I ran right in and I sat right down and I ordered up some wine. My talk was fast and clever, and the women all were fine. Charlotte asked me where I'd been with jade and ivory eyes, and I told her I'd been hung up with some beggar in disguise. Well, she laughed like temple bells. She kissed me on the cheek and said, "You know, it's hard to be alive sometimes, but it's easy to be dead."
I feel like I should know that song, and I don't. Tell me something about the song.
It's an old folk song, and it was originally recorded by, might even been written by a band called Jerry Hahn Brotherhood, which was a band that I saw play probably in 1968, opening up for Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And they played that song, and I went, "Wow!" But that's my party song. I've been playing this since I've been playing that song since I was 17 years old.
To really cheer up the party.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful song.
It is. It is. It's been great to talk with you. I really appreciate your doing this, and thank you for playing for us. I think it was just really generous of you. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
John Mellencamp's new CD is called Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. Here's another song from it. This is Don't Need This Body.
Ain't I gonna need this body much longer? Ain't I gonna need this body much more? I put in a 10 million hours. Washed up
You can hear more songs from John Mellencamp's new CD, Life, Death, Love, and Freedom, and hear our interview, too, on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air. Zoe Heller's 2003 novel, Notes on a Scandal, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and made into a film starring Judi Dench and Cate Blanchett. Heller is known for crafting characters difficult for readers to cozy up to. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that in her latest novel, The Believers, Heller continues to resist the easy allure of the lovable.
Zoe Heller has no patience with what she calls the relatively new phenomenon of relatability in literature. She's already been chided by reviewers for not including obviously likable characters in her latest novel, The Believers. But Heller, rightly I think, rolls her eyes at the dumbed-down, mid-cult notion that every novel must contain an Atticus Finch in order to secure readers' attention. Heller gambles on her readers' intelligence and wit rather than baldly appealing to our feelings. The chilly social satire that Heller expertly executes in The Believers makes it a standout novel. She may not give us characters to like, but Heller likes her readers enough to credit us with wider reasons for reading novels than just to latch onto characters to identify with. The Believers dissects the family of an elderly left-wing lawyer named Joel Litvinoff. Joel, like William Kunstler, has devoted his life to defending radicals and subverting convention. One of his adult children recalls how Joel, an atheist, of course, would respond to invitations from friends whose children were making their bar or bat mitzvahs. Joel made it a point, she recalls, to send back all invitations to such events with the words, "There is no God," scrawled rudely across their engraved lettering. At first, it seems as though The Believers is going to focus on Joel, because after all, he is something of a living legend. But Joel is dispatched rather early in the novel. He's felled by a stroke and lingers comatose in a New York hospital while his wife and children must realign their orbits. Indeed, and this is the only flaw worth mentioning in The Believers, everyone's faith in Joel is rocked when it's discovered that he's had a long-term love affair with a woman who's born their son, now 8. Don't guys like this, outsized, charismatic public figures, always have affairs and out-of-wedlock children? Joel's family shouldn't be all that aghast. But finding that their secular socialist saint has clay feet, the family spins off in different directions. Daughter Rosa, who's lived a fiercely ascetic life in Cuba for the past few years, has returned to New York and becomes drawn to, horror of horrors, Orthodox Judaism. Another daughter, Carla, is figuratively speaking the family punching bag. Overweight and unhappily married to a working-class union organizer who alternately idolizes and derides her famous lefty family, Carla stumbles into a tentative affair with an apolitical Egyptian immigrant who runs the newspaper stall in the hospital where she works. Son Lenny is a perpetually recovering heroin addict who slowly discovers the disciplined pleasures of exercise and woodworking. The most satisfying stealth character in the novel, however, is Audrey, Joel's English wife, who spent her life proudly in his shadow. Audrey has made a reputation for herself as a tart truth-teller. When a big-hearted rich friend suggests that, given Joel's vegetative state, the exhausted Audrey might want to join her on a trip, a Caribbean cruise, for instance, that The Nation magazine organizes, Audrey snaps, "I'd rather stick a pin in my eye." "Oh," says the patient friend, "it looked quite fun to me." "What?" sneers Audrey, "floating around the islands with a bunch of old guys, quarreling over who gets to sit in the jacuzzi with Katrina Vandenhoevel?" Audrey's meanness, entertaining though it may be, stirs up so many interesting questions in this acerbic novel of ideas. Is nastiness always a good indicator of insight? Is intelligence always a higher virtue than kindness? And please, The Believers warns, think twice about those knee-jerk answers, gentle readers. Maybe running off with her non-judgmental, unread lover would make Carla happier for the nonce. But whatever are they going to talk about in the years to come? By refusing to pander, to serve up even one likable main character, The Believers also raises implicit questions about our readerly expectations about fiction. You may not make new imaginary friends by reading The Believers, but as consolation, this smart, caustic novel reminds us that fictional friendship can be overrated.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Believers by Zoe Heller. You can read an excerpt of it on our website, freshair.npr.org.